Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we're starting the show today by talking about cross-country skiing with our guest, Jesse Diggins. In March, she won the last race of the season in Sweden and the overall and distance cross-country World Cup Crystal Globes. Her six individual wins in the 23-24 season were the most races an American has ever won in a single cross-country season. And she's with us today to talk about her season during which she raced to victory in Hayward, Wisconsin. Did you see her ski her way into history? Give us a call with your own questions or comments, maybe your own experiences cross-country skiing. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Jesse Diggins, welcome back. Good to have you back with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
It's been great. It's been, I think, about 3 years ago we talked with you, maybe when your book Brave Enough first came out. But I want to congratulate you on your incredible season. Have you had kind of time to soak it all in?
Yeah, you know, I think I finally have, right? If you'd asked me right at the end of the season, I would have been just like, I don't even know what happened. I'm still trying to process it. But now I've had a little bit of time to kind of come down and look back and really appreciate what a fun and wild ride it was.
It had to be fun and a wild ride for sure. The World Cup itself, you know, we have a lot of cross-country skiers here in Wisconsin. I'm not sure everybody understands the World Cup. Can you describe it for us?
Yeah, for sure. So pretty much everyone knows we have the Winter Olympics every 4 years. And then the year before and the year after that, we have World Championships. So, for example, this year we have the World Championships in Trondheim, Norway. But then every single season, all winter from late November to late March, we race the World Cup circuit. And that can get a little confusing because, like, in soccer, the World Cup is just every 4 years, and it's one big tournament. But for us, World Cup racing is actually just a series, and we move from country to country pretty much every week. And so we're racing Saturday, Sunday, sometimes Friday, Saturday, Sunday. People can follow along with the FIS app for results. They can also watch us race live or on demand later. The commentary is awesome. So they can follow along and get to know their favorite skiers. And it's super fun because it's happening pretty much every weekend all winter long. And that's what was that's what we were doing in Minneapolis. That was one of the stops on the World Cup tour.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And I want to get to that. But you won your first overall World Cup title in 2021, if I'm not mistaken. How did this season compare to that one 3 years ago?
Well, that was the first of our like COVID years in the winter. Yeah. So it was definitely very stressful. Really high emotions. You know, it was a lot of, hey, if I can even just make it to the start line and be allowed to race, that's great. And so it was a surprise, and it was amazing. And to be honest, we didn't really celebrate very much because we were just trying to safely exit Europe and re-enter the U.S. at the end of the season. And so this year it definitely felt like, okay, we can celebrate a little more. We're a little less stressed about the overall situation here. And I just, yeah, it was really special because we achieved this as a team. This wasn't just something that I achieved. This was all of the WASTETs who worked so hard every single race all winter. This was all our coaches, all our support staff, all our volunteer doctors and PTs. There's so many people who put so much into this team so that we can go out there and race as hard as we can. So I really feel like this overall victory was a team effort and a team victory. And it was really special to get to celebrate it with everybody. And it was extra special because this season there were no world champs and there were no Olympics. So the World Cup overall was a big prize.
Yeah.
In the winter. And that made it all the more special to be able to bring it home.
Yeah, a big deal. Peggy in Cedarburg has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Peggy.
Oh, hi. I am so excited to hear Jesse on your program, Larry. A couple years ago, I was volunteering with some of my friends. We call ourselves the Berkey Babes. And we helped take your skis off at the finish line. And it was such a thrill. And I really appreciate all you've done to elevate cross-country skiing in the country here and abroad. And congratulations on your incredible achievement. Okay, my question. As I get older, I'm wondering if I need to change my style or slow down or do less skiing to maintain fitness, but then, you know, not get injured. So I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. So, Peggy's getting older? Peggy's getting older, and that's a good question, I think.
I think it's a great question. Well, thank you so much, Peggy, for the cheering and for volunteering and ski races and helping everyone at the finish line. That's really special, and it makes the race experience that much more amazing. So thank you. And I love your question because I always have believed that cross-country skiing is a lifelong sport. And it's so special because you can choose the effort and intensity that you go out at. So it's a little bit like running where you're like, yes, you can absolutely punish yourself and try to run a marathon at record pace, or you can just go out and jog and enjoy being on the trails. And with cross-country skiing, I love how, you know, in Norway, we see 80-year-old skiers out skiing the Berkey just at their own pace, just loving it, enjoying it. And so I don't think you have to change your style. I don't think you have to cut back the amount you ski. I think the intensity is completely up to you, and definitely making sure that you have the right wax on your skis can make it a more enjoyable experience, because then your skis are gliding a little bit easier and a little bit faster, which means you can put a little less effort and still be getting along the trail at a fun pace. So I think you can do it as long as you want to get outside and be enjoying the winter trails with your friends. So I don't think you have to stop or change your style. I think some of the beauty of the sport is having two totally different techniques to choose from. And because it's non-impact, even though it's a weight-bearing sport, you're gliding instead of pounding. So there is no impact. And so I think it's really safe to do as long as you're having fun.
Yeah, it is a lot of, I was thinking back over the year, as you were talking, I was thinking back over the years of cross-country skiing for me, and I'm certainly not going, let's say, as fast as I used to go, but it's still enjoyable to get out there.
Absolutely. I mean, my big goal is to ski the Berkey with my grandkids someday. Like, I really still want to be skiing as long as I'm alive. I want to be out there enjoying the winter trails, bundled up in some layers and just enjoying being out there. So that's my goal for sure.
Tom in McQuantico has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Boy, it's a pleasure to talk to you, Jesse. I'm one of those longtime skiers. I got 25 Berkeys in and a bunch of Cordalopas, probably another 10 of those, and then other races up there. And, yeah, you can ski forever. And I just wanted to say thank you for bringing such, panache to the sport. So many people are so excited about you, and you're such a great spokesperson for what we do, and what the team is doing. And the team has been pretty spectacular. I did want to ask one other question, though.
Sure.
Because I've followed your career quite a bit. You tried biathlon last year, and you said you kind of liked it. You want to elaborate on that?
Okay. I love this question. Thank you so much, first of all. And so I did try biathlon. I'd never shot a rifle before, and we were doing a set of roller ski races in Soldier Hollow in Utah. And the biathletes stayed after their races to teach all of us how to shoot. And I was like, well, I want to try it. That sounds really exciting. And so I tried it. I did love it. But I will say I'm so attached to my team. And to my specific teammates, I love the biathletes. They're amazing. But I've grown up on the road with my cross-country family. And so I don't think I could ever leave this family and this group of people. And that's part of what makes this sport so special. So I love cheering for biathlon. I love watching it. I would love to try it, like, recreationally. I don't know if you can recreationally shoot and ski. I don't know if I should say that on air, but I would love to try it some more. But I don't see myself making a switch.
There you go, Tom. Thanks a lot for calling. Well, Jack in Madison is on the line. Let's go there. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Larry. How's it going?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Yeah, well, a couple of things. So I am a two-time Coeur d'Alope finisher, and, you know, I feel really happy to have been, you know, taken part in one of the main events of the American Berkey Biner Gone Skiing up here. But I'm sure whatever I've done pales in comparison to what the multi-talented and accomplished Jesse Diggins has. Jesse, I feel very honored to speak with a pro athlete and an ambassador to the sport of cross-country skiing like yourself. This is really cool, you know, everything that you've done for the sport. I know I'm not the first caller to laud you with your accomplishments, but I guess to throw a question your way and kind of change things up, how did you first get started as a cross-country skier, and then what's your advice to people who are thinking of taking up the sport and then going pro with it, or just seeing how far they can go with their careers? Like, how would you go about doing that?
Well, thanks. These are awesome questions. So I first got started because my parents loved skiing. So my first introduction to the sport was from my dad's backpack, and he would just put me in there and go on skiing with my mom every weekend in a different park. They loved driving around to different parks from Wisconsin and Minnesota because we live really close to the border. So we would just go to different parks. And then when I was about 3 years old, we joined the Minnesota Youth Ski League. And that's where I learned how to ski. And it was mostly playing games, playing tag on skis, going on scavenger hunts on the different trails. It was all about having fun with friends while building some skills, but it wasn't serious racing. And that developed a real love of being outside in the winter and a love of the sport for me. And then I got more serious when I joined the high school ski team. So for people who are looking to try out the sport, you know, maybe get into it for the first time, I always recommend starting with a lesson, because I think getting some basic fundamentals with the technique will make it so much more enjoyable, so much more fun. And I also say give it a couple tries, because I think by the time you tried it for the third time, you're moving a lot more efficiently, and then it's starting to really become fun, and you're seeing the progress, like, oh wow, I'm getting my balance and figuring it out. And things are always more fun when you feel like you're not struggling against your skis or equipment. So I always tell people, like, be patient, give it a couple tries, and start out with a lesson. And then for anyone looking to potentially go pro or take it to the next level, for me, a big part of it is finding a coach that you really like and that you trust and that you think you can develop a good relationship with them, and they can help you create a training plan that really works for you and your life and the kind of athlete that you are. And I think that's really important. And then also finding a training group and a team that, again, like, that works for you and your life, and you work with them. And I think it's so much more motivating, especially if it's cold and rainy and you don't really feel like going out or roller skiing and you need to go get the workout done, knowing that your teammates are there and waiting for you and counting on you to contribute to the team effort and contribute to the workout dynamic. Then you're going to get out the door and you're going to go do it. So I think joining a training group and joining a team is huge.
Jack, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Our guest today, Jesse Diggins, reflecting on her latest World Cup winning season, cross country championship, and certainly taking your calls and some great calls so far. What about you? Questions or comments for Jesse Diggins? I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, email address ideas@wpr.org. Joel Patnod, our producer today, our technical director, Jeff Robbins. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR. Larry Mueller here with my guest, cross-country skiing champ, Jessie Diggins, reflecting on her World Cup winning season and taking your questions and comments. I hope you join in. If you have one, give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Steve in Bayfield. Hi, Steve. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Hi, Larry. Hi, Jessie. How are you guys?
We're great. Thank you for calling.
Okay, just a quick note. I'm in Bayfield, and I play in a band, and we played a fundraiser for the Berkey Beiner Foundation, and it was a pretty high buck per plate meal. They raised a lot of money, and Jessie was there, and also I believe Gus, your contemporary skier from Wisconsin. But anyway, I got to tell you how gracious and accessible Jessie was. There's probably a couple hundred young ladies there with their dads and moms waiting in line to get pictures and autographs and that sort of thing. And so just wouldn't just compliment her on what a good ambassador for the sport she is.
Oh, Steve, thank you so much for calling. Do you remember that event, Jessie?
Yeah, thank you, Steve. By the way, the music was phenomenal. Really impressed. Thank you so much. And it was really an honor to be there.
That's great. Thank you. So, well, you won this year's Berkey, by the way. We should probably mention that.
Oh, yeah, and so did Gus.
And so did Gus.
That was really exciting.
Oh, man. Joe and Eau Claire. Joe, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I wanted to congratulate Jessie on her season, and I did get to see her ski by 5 times in the Berkey Beiner because I was one of the old-fashioned riders, and we didn't go till Sunday, so we got to go out along the trail side and watch her zip by. But I wanted to give a mention to her book. I know you mentioned it briefly in the introduction, but for anyone interested in skiing, it was a fun read. It was fun reading the play-by-play of your famous relay with Keegan Randall. And I thought the part about the eating disorder was interesting, too. You wrote very candidly about your struggle with an eating disorder. And for anyone who might ever be working with young athletes, especially girls, I think that was very important.
Thank you, Joe, for calling. Comment, Jessie?
Yeah, thank you so much, Joe. I really appreciate your words because that truly was the reason I wanted to tell my story and write the book. Of course, the stories about skiing and the Olympics and the racing were super, super fun to share, but it was so important to me to provide a potential, icebreaker, a way for parents and children to open up a conversation about mental health and eating disorders, and a way for coaches to understand what might be happening inside the minds of the athletes they coach if they're struggling. So I'm so glad to hear that you found it interesting and insightful, and thank you very much for your kind words.
Yeah, thanks very much. Appreciate it. You know, you've been pretty open about experiencing a relapse of an eating disorder. What happened there?
Yeah, well, so I started struggling again this past summer, and I knew right away that, this isn't something that I should have to keep secret or be ashamed of. I've learned so much since my first experience when I was 18 years old. I've learned that, mental health, it's as important as your physical health, and it's just as important to reach out for help. It's not something that I have to try to fix myself. If I break my arm, I would go to the doctor. I wouldn't try to just fix it myself. And so I went back to my care team and I asked for help, and I got so much unconditional support. My family, my husband were so incredibly caring and supportive, and it was as well as my team. And so it can be really, really scary to share with your support team and with your family when you're struggling and need help. But I have found time and time again, every time that I share, I have been shown how much these people love me and how much support they're willing to give and how they have my back unconditionally. And it's really powerful. And it's honestly brought us all even closer. So while I wouldn't wish upon anyone to go through a tough time and a struggle, I feel like the silver linings are that you get to find out just how much you're loved by all the people in your life who want to be there for you and who want to support you. So even though it's really scary to do that initial asking for help, it has absolutely been worth it every single time.
Very, and I saw a quote, you were quoted in The Guardian as saying, eating disorders are a mental illness, not a behavioral choice. It can affect anyone of any age, any race, any background.
Exactly. And I think there's still a lot of stigma around, especially eating disorders and mental illness. I think we have a lot of education to do. And that's why it's so important for me to talk about it and point people out to where they can go find resources. You can go to the EMILY program. They have a lot of helpful things on their website. You can go to the National Eating Disorders Education website, and they have a lot of information there as well. And I think it's just important to learn a little bit about it because, as you mentioned, it's not a behavioral choice. And, they're very real and they are very dangerous. And so it's very important that we learn how to support people.
Jessie Diggins, our guest today, great to have her back with us to talk about cross-country skiing and her second overall World Cup cross-country skiing title. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Someone else wondered, how do you push through the pain and exhaustion you feel during races?
Oh, that's a great question. So a lot of that is practice. And so that's where training comes in. Like in a big moment, in your big race, it's not the first time that I've experienced feeling that uncomfortable. But I think for me, the biggest thing is that I ask myself two questions. Am I doing the best that I can right now? And if the answer is yes, I'm just going to keep doing that. But if the answer, when I'm being honest, is no, I could actually be doing a little bit more. Then I have to be honest with myself and I have to dig a little bit deeper so that I will always be proud of what I put out there in the race. And then I also ask myself, how do I want to feel at the finish line? Because I think we can all relate to this. Sometimes you cross the finish line and you're like, oh, okay, it's over. And you give yourself a minute to catch your breath. And then you look back and you're like, ooh, I'm really not as tired as I maybe should be right now. Like, I definitely held back. I have a lot of extra energy that I could have given during the race. And I don't like that feeling at all. I like crossing the finish line knowing that I put it all out there and I didn't hold back. And so when I ask myself that question mid-race, it's a really good motivator for me to keep pushing through the discomfort in the moment.
I tell you, I watched a short video, sort of a summary of the, which was exciting to watch, even though I knew how it was going to turn out. You had a lot of top three finishes, but the one that I was watching had to do with you losing a ski pole and a glove.
Oh, yeah. That was very exciting. That was, I think, our third race of the entire season. We were in Ruka, Finland. And somebody, just by accident, it happens in mass star racing, they stepped on my pole and my whole glove and the pole came right off my hand because it was quite cold out and I was wearing mittens, so I didn't have the straps as tight as I should have. And when I went to get a spare pole, we were moving quickly and I goofed up and I actually took the pole handle to my face and it hit me in the lip. And so I had this big fat lip and blood all over my face. And I had a spare pole that was a biathlon strap, so it wasn't, my hand was pretty loose in there, and I didn't have a glove. And at the finish line, it looked really dramatic. It probably looked so much worse than it actually was, but I actually didn't know I was bleeding because I was so focused on the race in the moment that I had no recollection of getting hit in the face at all. So I looked down, and my other glove was covered in blood, and I was like, whose blood is this? I was very confused.
Well, that was amazing to me because there you are skiing along with one pole and grab that other pole sort of on the fly. And so you had to go all the way back through the group of skiers and wound up in second place and was really pushing for first.
it
was an amazing performance.
I went from first place to 12th place back to second place, all in the span of about 5 minutes. So it was exciting.
Oh, it had to be. John and Cornell, speaking, we've been talking a little about equipment. John and Cornell, I think, has an equipment question. John, hi.
Hello.
Hi, John.
Hey, my question, I don't follow the sport very closely, but how does she feel about transgender men in her sport? And if they compete in it, how fair does she think that is? Thank you.
You know what? I was totally prepared for all the questions about equipment, but I haven't prepared an answer to this one yet, so... I'm just going to hold off until I've had some time to think about it.
Well, I thought he was going to ask about equipment. And so let's talk about equipment for a minute. For the person who is wanting to just get out there and start for the first time, or maybe they've tried it a few times and now want to get some equipment, what's your advice on skis and poles?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a little bit biased because I am a Salomon athlete and I've raced every race in my entire World Cup career on Salomon skis. But what I also love is they sell a variety of like a graduated system of skis. So you have everything from touring skis, you've got fish scales, you've got skins so that you don't actually have to put kick wax in the wax zone. When you're classic skiing, you can just pull them out of your car, put a little liquid glide wax on the glide zones, buff them up, and you're good to go. So I love that because there are a lot of options out there where if you're like, hey, I have an hour after work, I'm going to stop by the park on the way home. I don't want to spend a lot of time taking, you know, elaborate care of the equipment. You have some more entry-level packages that are really going to help you get out the door and get on the trails. And I love that. But if you're going for your third, fourth Berkey or more, and you're like, all right, like I'm moving up waves and I'm ready to, you know, take the commitment to make that next step, similar to getting a nicer bike, you know, upgrading to that next pair of skis is going to make a difference for you. And I always recommend people go to their local ski shop and ask for help getting skis that are fit specifically to them, because it does matter, especially the plastic skis, that they're fit to your weight range so that you're compressing them at the right time to get good kick. So, and the same with skate skis, like there are different lengths and different stiffnesses of ski. So definitely like visit your local ski shop. They're probably going to be super friendly and super helpful, and they're going to help get you set up.
Jim in Menominee has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Hello there. Thanks for taking my call. Great to talk with you, Larry and Jesse. Congratulations on your accomplishments. It's I was really pleased to hear you talk about how cross-country skiing can be a good low-impact exercise for folks who aren't those who would try and be in the exciting racing scene that you're in. I've been a skier for years. I've skied 44 Birkebeiners and involved in the Birch Leggings Club. And it's got us to really appreciate winter and like winter, look forward to winter. But this winter, as you know, has been a real struggle with the lack of snow, warming climate. And I know Jesse's been involved with speaking out to try and keep winter snow, work with doing things to mitigate climate change. And I was just wondering if she could let us know what some of the winter-specific or snow-specific avenues there are for us to make our message known to folks who have influence, politicians and so forth, using winter as a theme for mitigating climate change.
Yeah. Jim, thanks for calling. Jesse?
Yeah, I love that. So I actually serve on the board of Protect Our Winters, and they're all about mobilizing athletes and people in what they call the outdoor state. So anyone who is invested in being outdoors and protecting the outdoors in all seasons you know, it's our responsibility to make sure that we vote and we show up and we help influence these policies that are going to swing the needle in a really meaningful and faster avenue. So I think it's all about this awesome blend of personal accountability and big systemic change. So one thing I encourage people to do is call your representatives. You know, call your senator. Say, hey, you know, I love skiing the Berkey. I've skied 44 of them. I want to make sure that we can continue to have this really special event and continue to have all these awesome ways for people to get outside and be active and be healthy in the winter. This is really important to me, and I would love to see you take a really strong stance on protecting our climate. And that's really all you need to say, but when they hear from so many people over and over again, wow, like people are really passionate about climate. People are really passionate about protecting, you know, their snow and having four seasons. This is important to them. It keeps bringing climate to the top of their crazy big to-do list. And it keeps reinforcing the message, like, my constituents care about this. They want to see me act on this. So a simple phone call can take 30 seconds, or writing a letter to your representative can let them know, hey, I care. I'm watching what you do. And, you know, your actions will impact how I vote. And then the second thing I always tell people is make sure you vote, and vote on the local levels, too. Take a moment to check out, you know, I mean, and I know it's not just a moment, it's a lot of work and everyone's busy and everyone has a busy life. So I know it is, you know, asking something to ask people to carve out time to do this, but it is so, so important that you make your voice heard. This is the biggest way that you can impact who makes these huge decisions. And so please make sure that you're registered to vote and that you do so, because that's one of the biggest ways to make your voice count.
Well, well said. Jim, thanks again for calling. Bob in Cambridge will give you a chance. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Thank you for having this show, and congratulations on all your success, Jesse. I just wanted to – I have a nephew who's a biathlon racer, or raced at a pretty elite level for a long time. I think he might have even – skied with you at some point, and I wondered what you thought about I feel as though the Nordic sports, that biathlon and cross country, they just don't get the glamour and the coverage that downhill and ski jumping and snowboarding do. And I just wanted to thank you, first of all, it's an odd thing, but thank you for winning and keeping it in the public eye, and thanks for being such a good representative of the sport.
Oh, Bob, thank you. Well, it's nice to hear that, Jesse. I'm sure.
Well, thank you so much, Bob. And I think, yeah, we're doing what we can to keep growing these exciting sports, and we support each other so much. And so I think it's really cool to feel like we're slowly but surely, we're doing it. We're growing the sports.
You know, I think you probably used a little of your influence to get a Midwest race to Minneapolis in February, that's what I'm guessing anyway. But that must have been, for you to return to Minneapolis, which is what, just west of Afton, where you grew up, and then have tens of thousands mm-hmm. of fans show up in Theodore Worth Park to cheer you on. What was that like?
Oh, I have to say, that was a career-long dream come to life. I had always wanted to be able to race a World Cup in my own country, and it took just over 300 World Cups raced all around the world for over a decade before I finally got to come home and race. It was the first time I had raced in Minnesota since I was 19 years old, and I'm 32 now, so it was a long-awaited homecoming, and it couldn't possibly have been more special. All the amazing folks at the Moffitt Foundation, all the volunteers, every single person who's involved made it such a special World Cup. And I have to say, athletes and coaches and wax techs from every other country all around the world, the whole rest of the season, they kept saying, oh, but how about Minneapolis? That was so special. Like, they really felt so welcomed and they loved the experience. And I can't think of a higher compliment than that. You know, you have coaches who've been doing this for 20 plus years, and this stood out to them because all the fans were so passionate and so excited, and everyone did such a great job making the world feel so welcome. So I have to say, thanks for the Midwest hospitality, because it really shone through and people loved it.
Oh, man. Well, you're 32 years old. What's the upper end, do you think, for you or for most skiers who are competitors like you are? I mean, is there an age restriction on that kind of thing?
You know, it's funny because we were talking about how, you know, you can ski for your whole life. And we've seen athletes be top 10 in the world at age 40 on the World Cup. So it's a long lifespan at the highest levels of competition. And I love that. You have many, many years to enjoy it and to keep growing and learning. And I feel like right now, I feel like there's still some potential out there for me to grow and improve, especially in the technical side of things. So I'm very excited to be starting off my training season, because I feel like I have another level that I want to reach. I've definitely got a lot of goals. So I don't know when the exact end date of my career is going to be, but it's so exciting to know that, you know, you're still growing, still learning, and you can do this for quite a long time. I really think the limiting factor is more that it's so hard to be on the road and away from your partner and your family and your friends. I think that's really, really challenging, to be gone and mostly in Europe for 4 months out of the year. And that, I think, is what will eventually convince me to be at home more.
Well, you take a break, or you did this year at least. I think Joel was telling me, I didn't see your Facebook post, but Joel Patnod was telling me that you took a 10-day break.
Yeah. Well, so that was my minimum that I set for myself, and I ended up taking a little bit more, but I try to have a minimum of 10 days in the spring where I'm truly not exercising. Like, maybe I go for a little walk or do yoga, but I'm not sweating, I'm not running, I'm not doing anything other than taking a stroll around the neighborhood, you know, with my husband when he comes home from work. And it's just really, really important to me that I give my body a big chance to absorb all of that intensity of racing and reset, and also give my mind a good chance to just, you know, reset. And so that when it's time to start training again, I'm itching to be training. I'm chomping at the bit and I'm so excited and I really want to get out there and start roller skiing again. And only then am I ready to start training again, because if I don't give myself this break, I think I put myself at risk for injury. And I think it's important for people to know, like, you have permission to take a break when you need it. That's really important. And I think it, in our society that's very fast paced, it can be hard to reward yourself for slowing down and taking your break when you need it. But it's so important, because then I feel like I'm able to return so motivated and energized and excited and able to do better work when I come back.
Well, we're energized and excited to see what the next year holds for you, Jesse, in your racing. And I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I hope we can do this again. Maybe in April, when you take your break, we'll do it again. How does that sound?
Sounds awesome. I love this as an annual tradition.
Thanks, Jesse. Jesse Diggins, our guest today. She won her second overall World Cup cross-country skiing title in March of 2024. So, and obviously the most dominant cross-country ski racer in U.S. history, male or female. Great to be able to talk to her. And thanks for all the great calls and questions. You know, we got into climate a little bit there with a question from someone. And we're going to kind of keep the climate and weather side of things going as we visit with our weather guys. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, this month, Wisconsin has continued to see big day-to-day swings in temperatures, high winds, rain, even snow flurries. Larry Mueller here. The weather guys are back with us and ready to answer your questions about the wild arrival of spring. John Martin isn't quite here yet. He is an associate professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, but Steve Ackerman is.
And I'm happy to be here. I'm enthused about John coming, too.
Steve's the former vice chancellor for research and grad education at UW and emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. So great to have Steve with us. John will soon be here. But as we talk with Steve for the moment, how are you responding to the ups and downs of the weather lately? Do you want some recommendations for maybe better weather apps to have on your phone? Give us a call. Regardless, the number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Well, I want to start with the eclipse because you're an eclipse professional, kind of getting to be one anyway. And there's some weather connected with it that we can talk about as well. But you were there for...
I went to the one in Arkansas. That was my third one. I've seen one in Wyoming and then one in North Dakota as well. And in all three cases, it was clear. So I was lucky for that, to be able to see it. But then also to experience some of the weather changes that we would expect to see during a total eclipse.
Yeah, it's... You know, this a dramatic change happens, does it not, in the weather?
Yeah, so in some perspectives, like temperature. Temperature can drop 10 degrees. And it seems surprising that it could go that much, because when you're seeing a total eclipse, even when it's 95, 96%, it's still really bright. You can't look at it with your eyes without, you know, squinting and getting hurt. But during that time, you're getting less solar energy. And so it is slowly cooling down. And by the time it goes total, you know, it's like an overcast day, even worse, because there's even less sunlight getting down to the surface than on a cloudy day. And then that decouples the upper atmosphere from the lower atmosphere. And so often it also gets calmer as well. Sort of like it happens in the early evening when the sun first goes down.
So do you get an increase in humidity then, too? You said?
So the relative humidity will go up because the water content in the atmosphere doesn't change in terms of how many molecules. But the relative humidity is directly tied to the temperature. And so as the temperature drops and the water doesn't change, the relative humidity automatically goes up.
Yeah. And that wind speed business, you know, it's something that we all experience. You know, somebody who does a lot of fishing or has done a lot of fishing, you know, when it gets dark, you know, as darkness comes, the wind tends to die down.
Yeah. And that's because the way that I think of it is during the daylight hours, when the sun is up, you're heating the surface. The air near the surface gets heated and hot air rises. And so when that hot air rises, there's air from above that comes down to replace it. And that air up above is often windier. And so you have a turbulence that generates the wind during the daytime. And then when the sun goes down, you no longer have that heating of the surface. You have that decoupling between the surface layer of the atmosphere and the layers above. And that causes the wind to calm.
It's a pretty cool experience. I always, as a musky fisherman, I always like that because I like to use topwater baits. And when it's just fun, you can use them when it's wavy, I guess, but it's more fun to have one of those creepers, Phillips creepers, just sort of creeping along the top of the water and then having a fish come up and grab it.
I used to do a lot of fly fishing, and it was the same thing when you had that nice, calm lake. It's just so beautiful to cast that fly and just sits on the surface. It just looks so pretty.
Oh, man. I love it for sure. Well, last May was the fourth driest on record in Wisconsin. Averaged a little more than an inch and a half of precipitation fell statewide last May. How likely is it we'll see another exceptionally dry month of May?
Hard to say. The general outlook is for cooler temperatures because El Nino is still in play. And usually that means it's going to be cooler and drier in our area. But in the May time, you know, is when we get a lot of convections, like we've been getting the last couple of days. And so you can have one convective storm and get over an inch of precipitation just from that one storm. So
yeah,
it really will be a function of, what is the convective situation?
We had, we get some mail relating to the show, and we got a letter from Douglas, who is in Red Granite, and wonders, had a question about accurate predictions. And he says, given that median scores are more stable than mean scores, median versus mean, would the use of median scores yield more accurate prediction when crunching weather data? And has that comparison ever been run?
I'm sure the comparison has been run. And what I'm thinking of here is the difference between the mean and the median. The mean is the average. So you take whatever the set of numbers is. Let's do temperature because it's easier for the word to say. You take all the temperatures for the month and divide it by the number of observations you have. And that's the average or the mean. The median is you find that value where 50% of the values are below and 50% are above. And so if you have a situation like temperature or a distribution that's normally distributed, like the classic bell curve, then the mean and the median are pretty much the same. So I don't think it will have much of an impact on forecasts for like temperature to see how well you're doing. If the distribution is really diverse, like trying to predict when the lake's going to freeze, that data is all over the place. And that's why when you hear the state climatologists get on and talk about the median date in which the lakes freeze, they won't talk about the mean. They'll talk about the median. And there's an example where, again, if you're going to look at what the forecast is going to be, you want to compare it to the median. So I think it depends on what the variable is in your prediction score.
Interesting. A caller who couldn't stay with us wanted to better understand the strange change in the light and air during an eclipse. We kind of talked about it. Go ahead.
Yeah, so it does change. It is eerie. It's different than what we get at nighttime. You know, so I was just making the comparison to the temperature drops to a fully cloudy day. But in a solar eclipse, you don't have clouds. So you do have light coming from those areas that are not in total eclipse, being scattered by the molecules in the air. And so it kind of gives you a eerie feeling that's different than sunrise or sunset. Because those areas, you know, it was around 1 o'clock in the afternoon, I think, you know, so they're still having a lot of sunlight being scattered by the atmospheres around us, not just in where the total blockage of the sun is.
Were you out in the open again? I remember last time you went, you talked about watching the darkness coming across the landscape.
Yeah, those first two times in North Dakota and Wyoming, it was flat. In Arkansas, it was also pretty open, but there were enough hills that I couldn't see the Terminator come at us. So even though I was telling everybody around, you know, with us, there was about half a dozen of us saying, oh, it's going to be so cool with the Terminator. You couldn't really see it. All of a sudden, boom, it got dark. And that was disappointing.
But. And everybody said, Steve, what were you talking
right,
about?
Right, yeah, exactly. Just looking at me. Right?
What's wrong with you anyway? Oh, but it's still
still phenomenal. It is really just an experience. And now we're not going to have one for a long time in the U.S.
When's the next one?
Oh, I think at least 10, 20 years or something. Something wrong. Yeah, I know, right? Right.
Well, I didn't notice very much of it this time around. I was actually in a meeting, but fortunately I was in a meeting in Madison where we had windows on two-thirds of the you know.
Ah, so you can look out the window. And
look out the window, but that is not, and, you know, I could barely, you know, it got a little darker.
Yeah, it's... Once you see a total one, it's really spoiling.
It's spoiling. I got to believe that for sure. Steve Ackerman, our guest today. Steve is the former Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW. Of course, also an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, talking weather and climate with him. And John Martin will be joining us, too, in a matter of a minute or two, a professor and former chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. We talk climate and weather, and they'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. And you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio, and we'll be back right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Taking a look at weather and climate on the program today with our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, one of our guests, the former Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW and an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John Martin joining us too, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And John, I got to say hello to you too.
Yeah, same to you, Larry. It's good to see you.
So what do you want to know about meteorologists' forecast visibility? Are you wondering how hot this summer is going to be? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@WPR.org. Vern in Boyd, Wisconsin, in Eau Claire County, up with a question. Let's go there. Hi, Vern.
Hi. I'm going to give you a comment first. Water vapor is the number one greenhouse gas, okay? So it's going to take probably till you're on next time to research this. Well, what is the effect of the Hunga Tonga volcanic eruption? That was on 15 January 2022, and it sent hot water 36 miles high. It was in the teragrams. You know, something like 140 billion tons. Plus, it sent sulfur dioxide 400,000 tons, like 90,000 feet, plus ash, and plus CO2. So that's going to be a long-term thing. You're probably going to have to take time to research it. The other thing I got to say, and I'll give you a title because it's going to take time for you guys to look this up if you can find it. Aviation's Dirty Secret, : airplane contrails and are a surprising potent greenhouse cause of global warming. You know, a lot of this comes out of Germany. By Katie, K-A-T-I-E, Camero, C-A-M-E-R-O. It's June 28th, 2019. So it's going to take time for you guys to research this, so I don't expect you to have a close answer, but you can do as best you can on this volcanic, because this is the biggest eruption, I think, in like 100,000 years.
John, you want to start, or
yeah. Well, I'll start with one comment. I think it's going to lead into Steve's. You know, you're right to point out that water vapor is a very potent greenhouse gas, no question about it. And adding water vapor to the atmosphere, if it weren't removed on a regular basis and systematically, would be very, very dangerous for the climate in the very near term. But we recycle the amount of water vapor that's currently in the atmosphere is 5 million billion tons or something like that, enough to cover the surface of the Earth with 1 inch of rain if it all came out right now. We recycle that 40 times a year. So a water vapor molecule does not reside in the atmosphere on average for more than 9 days. So it doesn't have too much time to do its dirty work in terms of the climate, unlike carbon dioxide and methane and some of these other gases that, as you pointed out, are long-lasting. So that's one thing. And I think the stuff about the volcano, Steve's an expert on some of those aspects.
Yeah, and what comes to my mind is, as an example, more modern-day one, is Pinatubo. Mm. So Pinatubo was another really explosive volcano. It set off a lot of sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere, into the stratosphere, where it can stay for a while, and it turned into sulfuric acid droplets. And what they do up in the stratosphere, very stable. They could stay around for a year and reflect solar energy back out to space. And that was in 1992, I believe.
Yeah, 91, 92.
Right, yeah, there. Yeah. And that caused the cooling. And in fact, it perturbed the climate record so much that we were about to get statistically able to say, yes, human impact has been affecting the climate.
Oh,
Pinatubo went off and it was like, now we got to wait until this natural phenomenon goes away to get back on track.
That's true. Wasn't that one of the first IPCC report eras? That's right, because the second one in 95 is the one that's often referred to, but not the first one from 5 years
And the first
earlier.
One was because of Pinatubo.
How do you like that? I didn't know
that. Statistically, and again, it's back to what we do with regard to using statistics, using data, and using scientific analysis to try and keep away from any of the biases that we sometimes held as human beings.
Yeah, very interesting.
Well, now, what about the contrails?
So the thing about contrails is, in theory, they could cause a cooling. Sometimes they'll spread out to a thin cirrus shield, but a lot of times the aerial coverage isn't that big. So globally, they would have a much less of an impact than, say, around an airport or the tracks on which these high aircraft jets fly in.
Yeah.
And contrails are water vapor, right? Aren't they? Or what are they?
Ice crystals.
Ice crystals. Ice crystals. But it's a form of water, so it's ice. Yeah.
And they're just what occurs just like on a winter day when we breathe. We get a little condensation, except it's occurring at a much colder temperature, so we get ice crystals.
And it depends on the available water vapor, which is highly variable from one place to the next, so that, you know, they don't, every time you have a jet engine going off at those high elevations, you don't leave the same contrail because it's not the same water vapor environment.
Yeah.
So
the statewide average temperature in May of 2023 was 57 degrees. That's 1.5 degrees warmer than normal.
Hmm.
Is climate change being felt seasonally in Wisconsin?
I wish I knew right off the top of my head in terms of that. The change that we're talking about is a global change. And so there's all kinds of variability regionally around that global change. I think it's fair to say that there are more frequent extreme precipitation events in the current day than there were 100 or so years ago. I don't know about, I think the average temperature has crept up several degrees in many of the, especially the warm season months, I think is probably right. And then the winter doesn't last as long. The ice on Lake Mendota does not last, doesn't come on as early, doesn't come off as late. Those are all things that are very definitely tied to the global change that is occurring on Earth. So, yeah, I'd say it's there's many different ways in which it's had an obvious and discernible impact.
And I think in the wintertime, for sure.
Yeah, I think that's also true, yeah.
There's the Wiki report that came out that looked at that. The Wisconsin Center for Climate...
Yeah.
Wisconsin Initiative for Climate...
For Climate Change Impacts,
right,
yeah.
So I wanted to bring up weather apps. I've got a couple on my...
Only a couple?
Well, three or four, maybe. Most smartphones come with pre-installed weather apps, which I've got. Those apps, they typically provide current weather conditions and forecasts for the next few days. How reliable are those apps in your mind?
So I have like 12 apps.
well, he's retired. He has more time now.
I have at least three radar apps, and each one is a little different. One is the individual radars, what they're seeing, and then one is from the National Weather Service where they blend them together, and then another one, kind of integrates them and does a forecast. So they're... In general, at least the ones that I have are really good apps. They're easy to use, and that's why I have them on. I think the other important thing to remember is that if you're buying one, and sometimes you would do that to get some extra service, but the data they're using is free. It's freely provided by the National Weather Service.
Yep.
It's paid for by our tax dollars, and that is really critical to me.
Me too. And so I kind of laugh a little bit when people compare what, the quality of the app is, it's really a matter of ease of use and what are some of the dimensions, but the data is all paid for by your taxes already. And that's rare. I think in the United Kingdom, I think you have to pay extra for various other parts of what ECMWF provides. You don't have to do that in the United States.
Yeah. And that's frustrating, particularly for radar data, right?
Yeah, right.
You want to know if it's raining around you. That's the only way really to tell.
I think that's the one that's most universally better understood by the average person today than it was 20 years ago. And it's a great service to the public to have that available.
Yeah.
And meteorologists who have their own business, they can fiddle with the data or, you know, zoom in, let's say, on data for, like, maybe their clients are farmers or maybe they're some other type of business.
Yeah, there's room for that kind of niche filling because the Weather Service's mandate is not to make site-specific forecasts for businesses or for farm interests. They give a broad thing for the broadest segment of the community. And so using information that's provided by the National Meteorological Center, private businesses can fill in some of those gaps. At a cost to say, you know, I don't want to say the wrong company, is it Chrysler down there at Belvedere, or I don't know which assembly they do. But anyway, they need to know, get things off the lot if there's going to be a hailstorm, because that does a huge amount of damage to their bottom line. And the Weather Service does not have the purview to make that call for them, so they have to pay someone else to do it.
Well, I know it works locally, too, because I had somebody from a car dealership say that they lost.
Yeah, oh man.
They had all their cars out, and a big hailstorm here hit that end of Madison, and all of those cars were just dented. Yeah.
I remember that now. And all of a sudden, there was a good sale.
It's a great deal. Right. Nobody hits a perfectly smooth golf ball. Larry knows that. The dimples matter. So.
Dean in Colorado has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Dean.
Hi. Good morning, folks. Or good afternoon, out your way. We had another snowstorm. I think we had Wisconsin's total of 8 inches for your annual sum this year, just this weekend. But we're recuperating. Anyway, my question is actually ties in a few callers here. How conservative do you think relative humidity is globally? And the reason why I'm asking that is as global temperatures increase, the water holding capability, saturation, vapor pressure is increasing exponentially, but humidification of the atmosphere is going on as well. And I was wondering if that's keeping up. So in other words, is the average global relative humidity dropping or staying the same? What do you think?
Yeah, I should know this off the top of my head, but I'm going to struggle to figure out to get the right answer. There isn't a right answer. There is a right answer out there. I think the global average relative humidity has not changed. And what instead has changed is the amount of water vapor in the air. And what is it? What's the ratio? Is it every 7% for a degree Kelvin of global warming, I think, the relative humidity goes up or something like that?
Sounds about right, yeah.
And or water vapor content goes up to meet that demand. And I can't recall if the global average RH has changed or if it's the global average mixing ratio, the amount of water vapor that's changed a little bit, because I thought the RH had stayed the same.
Yeah, yeah.
And that strikes me as maybe more my intuition, because we 3/4 of the planet's surface is covered by liquid water. So if you warm the temperature, you're just going to have more capacity, as you point out, and it's going to come from someplace because we have vast reservoirs. So I don't think you can really starve the atmosphere of water vapor under transformed conditions where it's a little bit warmer.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Dean. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. So meteorologists forecast the chance of rain in percentages. We got a question. How's the likelihood of precipitation calculated?
I think they're the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. Right? And they look at, so the National Weather Service, when it forecasts it, will look at, in the forecast area, what's the chance of there being rain, and then what area of that forecast area is covered by that rain.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a two mixtures of those calculations. I think the way that I like to explain it is the way that you explain it, that if it's a 80% chance of rain, then it means that if we had 100 days exactly like today, it would rain on any of those.
Yeah, so it's a probability of these conditions will lead to precipitation. How often?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's why it's important to have a radar app.
I agree.
Because if it's going to be an 80% chance of rain in Madison, you can be sure I'm checking that radar map anytime I'm going outside.
Yeah, that's right. And the county warning areas, they're called for the Weather Service. They're not, you know, huge, but they're not small. They're not your backyard. So if somebody says there's a 90% chance of rain and it doesn't rain in your backyard, they were probably still right for the job right, they're trying to do. And you're right, to supplement it with a real observation, which is the radar, you can say, oh, yeah, it looks like it's raining in Dodgeville, but not here. I don't have to worry.
Yeah.
You know.
So another climate question, what is the likelihood of, you know, assuming a progression and we don't beat climate change and it progresses, what is it going to look like in Europe versus maybe here? What are the calculations or the percentages that we see?
In terms of the temperature changes and precipitation and all that? Yeah, that's a broad question. I don't know all the detailed answer to that. I think there are some places that start to show up as climate havens. They're beginning to be called by some people. I think we're one of them, actually, because the winter is going to be moderated a little bit. And the summertime is going to be, you know, not horribly warm and dry and hot. It's going to, because we get enough rain in the summertime that we don't get those horrible heat waves they can get in the Southwest. So things like that are beginning to enter the consciousness of people as they ask exactly that kind of question, but try to put, you know, again, a background global change and trying to figure out how that's going to project regionally is not always very easy.
Yeah. So. I you know, you read so many different things. I was reading somewhere that Northern Europe was going to be a lot colder.
Well, I think that might have come from one of these recent discussions about will the so-called thermohaline circulation in the North Atlantic break down. If it breaks down, and there's some reasons to believe it, you know, this warming could exacerbate that probability, then that would mean that the Gulf Stream does not head toward Northwest Europe with anywhere near the vigor it has for centuries, and that would change the climate there, for sure, toward the colder side.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting, that coupling between how the ocean helps determine what our climate
is.
Yeah,
right.
Not just all the water, 70% of the globally covered water.
It's moving around.
The currents, too.
Yeah, exactly right.
So another emailer wondered about your research. What are you guys looking at here at the UW first, and then nationally, maybe internationally, in terms of research?
You want to go?
I'm retired, so my research is, how do you put a glass bottom cloth on my wooden boat
there
to
you
give
go.
It some strength?
There you go. Yeah, I'm thinking
I'm still working with NASA on some of their satellite stuff.
I'm thinking about other problems. Yeah. No, I'm thinking about the interannual and long-term variability of the Pacific, not only Pacific jet now, the jet both in the Northern Hemisphere and in the Southern Hemisphere. We've recently figured out that the jet streams at the tropopause level, about 9 kilometers or so, 5.5 miles above the ground, there's a double jet stream structure in the cold season in the Northern Hemisphere, but it turns into a single jet stream structure in the right after the end of April. April's the transition month in the way that we've been investigating this, and that will vary from year to year. But when you get to May through October, you're talking about a single jet, and that is a brand new insight about the nature of the circulation in the Northern Hemisphere. So this summer, we're going to be looking at the warm season in the Southern Hemisphere. I have a suspicion it's not the same down there. And that would, of course, prompt lots of new questions. We got to figure out why. If it isn't the same, why is it different?
And so, is that because of water? The amount of water or the...
I don't know. And that's what I'm guessing. There's less continentality. And I think that makes a difference. I do think that makes a difference. Yep. So we'll see if that's right.
So how do we use those data? I mean, let's say, you know, findings of this sort. How are they used?
That's hard to know. In fact, I think any scientist who always knows what his or her current results are going to lead to is one of those lucky people. I never feel that way. I feel like all I'm doing is trying to solve this problem, which has interested me. And very often, there are downstream benefits from having spent some time thinking about it. On this one, I don't know. I think this one might tell us something about, once we know where the jet is and how it behaves throughout the year, we can say something about whether or not it's gotten wavier in the warming era, and whether or not that waviness tells us something about how the circulation around the whole hemisphere has changed and is likely to continue to change in the face of some of the circumstances that have been brought about by the warming. So there may be those kinds of long-term consequences to better understanding where is the jet and what does it do at various times of the year at the tropopause. Because I think people who have been studying that have not been studying it from the perspective of someone who looks at weather maps every day, and that makes a difference.
And so, and the jet stream really is important to our daily weather as well.
It
sure
is.
If you lead to that understanding, I think it also will generally lead to an improvement in the weather forecasting.
I think so, or at least weather understanding. And very often, weather understanding leads to benefits in forecasting.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe not the, you know, the next day forecast, but maybe the 5-day forecast.
Yeah, that, right. Getting into longer term. That's a very good point. Thanks.
Where are we at seven-day forecast? What's our reasonable expectation if we see it's going to rain in 7 days in wherever?
I think it depends a little bit on the season. In the cold season, I'd say that's a 70%-ish probability of being right. Yeah. So in the same way we talked about just a minute ago, 7 times out of 10 presented with the same kind of prospects, you're going to find them right. And I think also one has to qualify that by saying that, you know, it's painting the complexion of the day accurately at 7 days. That's useful. I don't think the details are nailed down. Mm-hmm. But that's really valuable. If you can vigilantly pay attention to the weather a week in advance and say, yeah, it's going to be super cold next week, that's painting the complexion the right way, or it's going to be super humid or something like that. But in the summertime, maybe you have a little bit of a degradation at the 7-day interval. It might be only 5 days where you can feel that same kind of confidence.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that we're getting good at 5-6 days is why so many people have apps on their phone.
Yep, exactly right.
Because they may be with somebody and start talking about when they're going to get together next, and so they look and see what the weather maps.
Exactly. And I think it explains some of the myopia, too, of the fact that you guys used to be better at this 30 years ago. No. You're totally wrong.
Right.
We said that the other day.
Right,
yeah. The idea is that you used to demand of us correctly, we want a 3-day forecast that's accurate. Well, we can give it to you at 70% accuracy 35 years ago. Now we can give you 7 days at 70% accuracy, and you're forgetting that the 3-day is now 100% accurate,
right,
or close to it. So
yeah.
We haven't left those solved problems behind. We're going on to new challenges, and you're forgetting that.
But 30 days out, we're never going to get that 70%, are we?
There's people who don't think that. There's people who think we might. So
I mean, clearly we're looking at, you know, it's going to be warmer than normal and things like that, and that's pretty good. But to get pinpointed, I think, again, I think it depends on what your philosophy is about the ability to determine what the atmosphere, the deterministic capability.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to make a date-specific forecast, like for a wedding 3 months in advance, will it rain? Can I plan my thing outside? I don't see that happening at any time in my lifetime, or maybe the next generation's lifetime.
Yeah.
I think that's probably way out of line.
Yeah.
Well.
But get married anyway.
So. Yeah. It shouldn't discourage you from planning your event.
That's a very good point, Steve.
That's a very good point.
On that happy note, thanks, guys. Oh, it's always a pleasure. Next time we have to talk about seeding of aluminum in the air and how it affects our weather, the environment, and our soil. So hang on to that thought.
You bet.
We didn't get to that one, but we will next time round with Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys from the UW Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, UW-Madison. Great to have them with us. And they'll be back the last Monday of next month. Great to have Jennifer Cheverini come by tomorrow to talk about her latest novel. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on WPR. I'm Larry Mueller.